back to my home, calling me back to my memories of the place that I left long ago.
You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM, streaming online at freakradio.org. And today on the show, we're talking with Antonia Yuhas. Her new book, The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It, is the subject. She's going to be in Santa Cruz coming up Wednesday, October 15th at Bookshop Santa Cruz at 7:30. If you want to come down and ask questions, then she'll be talking about her book there as well. Antonia Yuhas is a leading oil industry, international trade, and finance policy expert and the author of The Bush Agenda. She's a fellow with Oil Change International and the Institute for Policy Studies. She has served as an aide to two members of Congress and holds a master's degree in public policy from Georgetown University. Yuhas is an award-winning writer and frequent media commentator, and her work has been featured in dozens of publications, including the New York Times, International Herald Tribune, LA Times, and Petroleum Review Magazine, as well as alternet.org. She has appeared on Kudlow & Company, National Public Radio's Diane Rehm Show, and Marketplace, Washington Journal, Hannity & Colmes, Democracy Now!, and Fresh Air, among many other shows. She lives in San Francisco, California, and she's joining us right now, I'm sure from the road, probably, to talk about her book, The Tyranny of Oil, and her visit to Santa Cruz next week. Hello, Antonia.
Hi, thanks for having me. And actually, thankfully, I just got home from being on the road last night, so I'm in back in California, which feels really good.
Great. So why don't we start off, if you could just talk maybe a little bit about the title of your book, The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. What do you mean when you refer to big oil and to the tyranny of oil?
Yeah, the motivation for writing this book came very naturally out of my last book, The Bush Agenda, where I was looking at different corporate actors and their influence on and within the Bush administration. And it's, how the policies of the Bush administration came to be why they took the shape that they did and looking at specific companies. And in that book, I looked at Lockheed Martin, the Bechtel Corporation, Halliburton, and Chevron. And in doing that work and looking at the policy environment that we're in right now, an environment where the vast majority of Americans oppose the war, where the vast majority of Americans, even Governor Sarah Palin, admit that climate change is real and it's a problem, and the rest of us tend to accept the next step further from that, which is that fossil fuels are the primary cause, or burning fossil fuels is the primary cause of global warming. My focus just became more and more and more and more centered on big oil and the problems associated with the size and power and political influence over these companies, that these companies hold over our government and how it affects our decision-making, and how I wanted to spend more time looking at that within the context of a full-length book to help me and those I work with our organizing activities on these other issues. And what that ended up looking like was looking at which were the companies that were the most profitable, because I'm equating profit with the ability to exercise political influence. I mean, profit is basically excess cash on hand that companies can do with whatever they want, and most tend to use that money to influence political decision making on their behalf. So, to get to your question, the companies that I then centered in on turned out to be the most profitable corporations, not just the most profitable oil companies, but the most profitable corporations on earth. And that is ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, Chevron, BP Shell, and then I add in Valero and Marathon, because if you look at those companies, those are the most profitable and largest oil companies operating within the United States, exercising the greatest influence over our political decision making.
How do we get here? What led up to the situation you describe where big oil and these major corporations control so much of, as you say, political decision making?
Yeah, I spend two full chapters of the book actually looking at history because I felt, first of all, that it was important to get a sense of where these different companies came from, how they got to be so large. But beyond that, in looking at the other books out there on the oil industry, there's really a lot of great books on the geopolitics of oil, the sort of broader scope of crude oil and the environmental impacts. But there hasn't been a book written about the individual oil companies themselves with a critical perspective since Anthony Sampson's classic book written in 1975 called The Seven Sisters. So I felt like I really wanted to fill in this missing history. But also, I wanted to start for the hopeful note. And so the place where the book starts is just a critically important comparison between the power and reach and grasp of Standard Oil, which was the largest, most powerful corporation in the world at the time, in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, and the populist movement that arose in the United States to break Standard Oil up. And it was just a time that was so similar to ours today, with large corporations being so economically powerful that they're able to dominate political decision-making. And what happened in the United States at the turn of the century was that the populist movement organized, demanded radical change. Some people wanted revolution. What they got was regulation. And the Democrats, the Republicans finally came on board. Laws were changed. Judicial decisions went through. And the Supreme Court eventually broke up Standard Oil into 34 separate parts in 1911. Something that people thought was impossible, the most powerful corporation in the world broken up into teeny pieces because of populist organizing. And we're in such a similar place today, with the economy being as unequal as it was then, with power concentrating into the hands of just a few corporations, with those corporations so powerful that they dictate policy, even when they're on the downside, even when they're collapsing, they dictate policies. It's amazing. But we also have a populist spirit. So essentially, the short answer is that between 1911, when the companies were broken up, and today, through some pretty clear policy decisions, we allowed the companies to put themselves back together. And Exxon was able to merge with Mobil, the two largest post-breakup pieces of Standard Oil. Chevron was able to purchase Gulf and then Texaco and Unocal to be the behemoth that is Chevron. BP was allowed to buy Amoco and Arco. Conoco and Phillips merged. Shell bought a bunch of little pieces of other companies. And through these merger policies, we allowed the largest, most powerful companies to come into being that the world has ever known.
But there is a model, as you say, for challenging that.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, it was very, very important to me to tell that story of populist organizing, particularly right now, as, you know, everybody and their brother has become a populist in the United States because of the collapse of the financial system. So we've got Governor Sarah Palin sounding like, you know, straight out of the turn of the century populist organizers. John McCain sounding like a populist. You know, we got to get the greedy, rich Wall Streeters to pay their fair share to Main Street. This is straight out populist language, and the reason why it sounds good to people is because it is the same problem. They are talking about the heart of the problem. They're just, McCain and Palin just aren't offering actual policies to fix it. But that language is what is resounding with the public, or sounding good to the public, because we are in just an analogous financial situation to where we were at that time in history, where we've essentially allowed, through deregulation, corporations to gain an upper hand over our political decision making, and we were able to deal with it then, and I'm very confident that we're able to deal with it today as well.
So, since you mentioned Palin, I remember when I was watching the vice presidential debate, how Palin kept seeming to go back and forth between saying, oh, I stood up to big oil, and then saying, everywhere we go, people keep chanting, drill, 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 and we, you know, she wants to drill in Alaska, wants to put a pipeline through, and all this kind of thing. So, I mean, I guess I'd just like you to assess some of the things being said by both major candidates right now and their VPs.
Mm-hmm, definitely. I wrote an entire chapter on crude oil and how it's priced and where it is and how we can get at it. Another chapter on refineries and gasoline stations, and tried to really sort of suss out what is the real situation with oil in the world and in the United States right now. What is the real situation with drilling? And Governor Palin is just an utterly fascinating character in American politics. She does have a unique history in Alaska. I mean, just to talk about her for a second, I would say the sort of bottom line of her policies in Alaska, and I'm not a full Palin scholar, but I've looked into it a little bit, and basically her position was that she wanted to get money to her constituents. She wanted to build money for Alaska, and she did that in two ways. One was an attempt to open up, all of Alaska's natural resources, essentially regardless of the, environmental consequences, the social consequences, the consequences to the people who live in coastal communities, open up every inch of it to drilling. And that included, by the way, joining into a lawsuit with the American Petroleum Institute, the largest lobbying group of U.S. oil interests in the country, to try and get the polar bear and the beluga whale delisted as endangered, as threatened species, so that their habitat could be opened up to drilling. I mean, that's how eager she is for oil drilling. At the same time, however, she did implement some more aggressive taxation on the oil companies. She did break up an attempt by the oil companies to essentially monopolize the building of pipelines, and she did do that. The thing that is that makes me very nervous about her is essentially what's being presented in the McCain-Palin ticket is the worst of both of those candidates. So McCain opposed offshore drilling until he started running for president, and until he got a huge chunk of money from the oil industry. So he now supports drilling everywhere. But he is a huge fan of low, low, low taxation. He wants to cut taxes on all companies. He wants to deregulate. He's a huge fan of deregulation. And then you've got Palin, who is a huge advocate of drilling everywhere, who at one time favored taxation and regulation policy, but it's essentially if you merge her intense desire to drill and his intense desire to drill, I'm sorry, her intense desire to drill with his deregulatory focus, you get the worst of both worlds. You get just a free door open to the oil industry, letting it go wherever it want without, reining in its impacts or its finances. And that's a very, very bad combination.
What about Obama and Biden? What is their main position on that issue?
You can summarize McCain-Palin as, at this point, essentially reading the talking points off of the American Petroleum Institute's wish list for what it wants in the world and in the United States, from war to drilling to low taxes to subsidies. That's the McCain-Palin ticket. Obama-Biden is definitely better, but it also definitely doesn't go far enough in my interest, because Obama, just like McCain, opposed offshore drilling until he started running for president, and now he supports offshore drilling. He has called for a topic we can go into in more detail later, which is re-regulating crude markets, which is very important and a very important policy that he's advocating. he does not advocate drill, baby, drill. He focuses far more on investing in alternative energy and has a more aggressive alternative energy plan. And he does focus more on reducing consumption, which I also agree with. What I don't agree with, at least two things I don't agree with, is Obama's adoption of the idea of what's called, I'll throw this out in quotes, clean coal, which is just a way to get money from the coal industry, nothing else. There is no such thing as clean coal. It doesn't exist. It's an idea for a plan that might be able to be developed in 10 years. It's just a way to get money from the coal industry. Very dangerous to advocate. And he advocates nuclear power, which I also don't advocate. Mm-hmm. And neither of the candidates talk about the things that I think are the most important, which are things like cleaning up our nation's refineries so that they're not as polluting, so that they're not as dangerous, so that they're more environmentally sound and safe for the communities around them. Aggressively reducing the very harmful environmental oil practices that our companies are engaged in, such as tar sand production in Canada, shale production in the Midwest, offshore drilling, which is incredibly environmentally harmful and dangerous. All of us in California should remember that the moratorium on offshore drilling came about because of a massive offshore oil drilling spill off of the coast of Santa Barbara in 1969. It was our state that led the way for the moratorium. And the human rights abuses, which we can talk about later, of the companies. So in my mind, neither ticket goes far enough. But of the two, I would definitely say that the Obama-Biden ticket is the less oily of the two tickets.
Mm-hmm. But you say Obama isn't focusing enough on cleaning up refineries. Neither one of them are, you say.
Yeah.
And addressing some of the environmental concerns as well as public health and safety concerns related to the behavior of these big oil companies. You mentioned the Canadian tar sands, and I'm wondering if you could delve into that a little bit, because I've heard that one thing they're doing to keep that operation going is to actually cut down forests to get at this stuff. So could you kind of describe a little bit more in detail some of the environmental impacts, not just in Canada, but starting with that, maybe?
Yeah, definitely. And this is the tar sand tar sands and shale and offshore drilling and refineries are four areas that I focus on in the book, in a chapter on the environmental consequences of where big oil wants to go in the future. And then another chapter is the war implications, so military implications of where big oil would like us to go in the future. But in terms of tar sand oil production, you know, actually maybe just to back up a little bit, one of my favorite parts of the book and where I learned some of the best information for myself was in looking at, you know, trying to unmask a lot of the media we see about the oil companies, which is that they're trying to make us believe that they are clean energy companies, right? Anyone who watches TV sees Chevron's advertisements where they, they have these lavish commercials that were filmed by the filmmaker who did Lost in Translation, whatever it's called, the person who produces the actual imagery, not the director. Very expensive, trying to convince us that they're a clean, green company. And the reason why Chevron and Exxon and Conoco want us to believe and are spending lots of money trying to get us to believe that they're clean energy companies is so, one, we will feel good. If we put Chevron gasoline into our cars, we will feel like we're contributing money to a clean company and that a company that's investing in alternatives, and that'll make us feel good. And it'll make us keep buying their gas. The other is so that we don't go to our elected officials and demand of our elected officials that they tax the industry and regulate the industry so that we can take that money and invest it into green alternatives, because we don't have to, because Chevron's already doing it themselves. And that's what they're hoping we will believe. The reality that I found in going through all of their tax returns and all of their expenditures is that none of the companies spend more than 4% of their total expenditures all expenditures no more than 4% on green alternatives. And that's BP. The rest of the company spend far less, 2%, 1%, 0.5%, 0. Chevron was at about 2% in 2006 and went up to closer to 4% last year. But that's the best that they have spent. And instead of being clean energy companies, they are massively moving into these incredibly environmentally harmful areas. So the tar sands is one of those areas. And as you say, first, to get into the tar sand region in Alberta, they have to engage in mass clear cutting of forests, which of course adds to the, reduces the ability of those forests to filter carbon and reduce its impact on climate. But then producing oil from tar sands essentially is estimated to be about three times more carbon intensive than other traditional forms of oil production. And that's because, just as the name implies, this is thick, sandy, gritty tar, and it has about 10% of all the material involved is actual bitumen, is actual crude oil. And first you have to dig the tar out of the ground. You have to use massive amounts of water to get it out of the ground. You have to move it. You have to heat it. You have to get that bitumen out of it. And that's an incredibly energy-intensive, wasteful process. Then you have the waste associated with it. You're throwing out the 80% of stuff you're getting out of the ground or 90% for the 10% of crude. And then you have to refine that dirtier bit of crude into gasoline. And the refining process is also dirtier because you have to burn off this more sulfur-rich crude to get it to become gasoline.
And then in the end, it turns out it takes more energy, is my understanding, to actually produce this than the oil that you get out of it.
That's right. So you've polluted the earth, you've cut the forest, and by the way, a lot of this area is First Nations land.
Mm-hmm.
You have to build pipelines to get it out of the tar sand area, which is environmentally destructive. And then you have to refine it into gasoline.
You also write in the book about Midwestern U.S. shale and offshore oil drilling. Can you talk about those things as well? Some.
Sure. And this is very crucial right now because not only did there's a lot of press attention on the Congress letting the offshore drilling moratorium go away. But that also happened for shale production in the Midwest. And shale is very, very similar in production to tar sand production. There's shale found in large quantities in Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, some in Texas, some in other states. And this is rock that's often 1,000 to 2,000 feet below ground, that when you get it out of the ground, when you heat it to 800 degrees Fahrenheit, you can get, similar to the tar sand, a teeny tiny bit of bitumen out of the rock. Now, to get the rock, what the mechanism generally used is just like coal mining, mountaintop removal, you remove the earth, you get the shale out. You have to use, again, a great deal of water to get the shale out of the ground. Then you have to heat it, and then you can get a teeny, teeny tiny bit of dirty, heavy crude out of that shale, which you can then refine, again, a dirtier process to refine. So this is an immensely, again, energy-intensive, more polluting because it's so energy-intensive, very environmentally destructive, very expensive, very uncertain form of oil production, which is being proposed now throughout the Midwest. And I go into in the book the history of shale production in the Midwest because it's been tried before, it's failed before, and many you know, small towns, I'm originally from Colorado, many small towns across the West suffered the economic consequences of oil companies coming in, promising lots of money, promising lots of production, damaging the earth in the process, and then packing up and moving out and leaving the communities, you know, economically devastated as a consequence, that have slowly built themselves back up to become tourism locations, environmental tourism locations, which are now once again being threatened by shale production. So I go into that quite a bit in the book. And then finally, offshore production. Chevron has really led the way in the fight on the Hill to try and get the moratorium removed on offshore drilling, and succeeded. And that was just through intensive lobbying, lots of money, lots of propaganda. And there's a lot to say about offshore oil drilling, and I will just say a little bit here. I think probably the most important is that Governor Palin likes to repeat this sentence that she advocates clean offshore oil drilling. And there's just no such thing as clean offshore oil drilling. It is a drilling platform. It produces pollution just in its production, air pollution, water pollution. It disturbs all of the water and all of the land around the enormous production facility, which is where, you know, there is marine habitat and other environmental life forms down there. But then just, from a straightforward climate perspective, one statistic I like to repeat is that any drilling that happens at depths of greater than 500 feet, and when they're talking offshore drilling now, they're talking about 1,000 feet, 5,000 feet further. Any drilling that happens at 5,000 feet, 500 feet or more, releases methane. And methane is a greenhouse gas 20 times more climate destructive than CO2. 20 times more. So every single hole that they drill is releasing this, you know, devastating greenhouse gas. And they want to drill. Offshore drilling is very uncertain. So about 80% of all offshore oil holes drilled in the Gulf are dry holes. You don't get any oil out of them. So they need to drill lots and lots and lots and lots of holes to get any oil. And so this is a, you know, deeply expensive, risky, and environmentally very unsound practice to be moving into.
So as you've described, big oil, which is a small number of major oil companies that control most of the U.S. oil industry, there's economic devastation to communities, there's human health problems related to areas that are near refineries, and also pollution, and as you said, they're only spending about 4% of their total expenditures on alternatives, on green alternatives, at the same time that they're painting themselves, you know, greenwashing and saying that, you know, we're doing so much for the environment. So all of this is going on, and as you said, these other things, the Canadian tar sands, the Midwestern U.S. shale offshore oil drilling, very energy intensive, polluting, not, you know, in some cases not even getting the energy that you put in out. Who's benefiting from all this? This is clearly, it seems like, a lose-lose situation. So who's lose-lose-lose? I mean, in all these ways.
Yeah.
And gasoline certainly is, even though the price is dropping quickly now with on a barrel of oil, it doesn't really seem yet to be getting to ordinary people. So it doesn't really seem like cheap gas is something that people are getting out of it. So who's benefiting?
Well, I mean, actually, the price of gasoline is actually going down at the pump, and I think, and that's important to take note of right now, because at the end of the day, basically the way that the oil industry ends up winning is that it successfully convinces the public, whenever we want to regulate the industry, whenever we want to tax it, whenever we want to, for example, your listeners might remember, And 2 years ago when we tried to pass Proposition 87, California is the third largest oil-producing state in the United States. The largest oil companies in the world produce here, Exxon, Shell, Chevron and Occidental. And Proposition 87 would simply have said, we want to tax you a little bit for taking oil out of the ground in our state. We'd like to get a little bit of money back for you getting this resource. And when the proposition was proposed, 65% of Californians said that they thought it was a great idea. 5 months later, the proposition died. And the number one reason that people said they voted against it was because they were afraid that their gasoline prices were going to go up. And that is because the oil industry outspent the proponents of Proposition 87 2-1. They spent $100 million trying to defeat the campaign, the most expensive ballot issue in the history of the United States. And they were prepared to outspend the proponents 3-1, 4-1, 5-1, however much it took. And I interview in the book the communications director, Yusuf Raab, for the advocates of Proposition 87. And he said the hardest thing in this campaign was that when we set out to do battle against the oil industry, no one in California understood that big oil was our challenger, because the industry spent so successfully on front groups, paying for studies to be done, seemingly independent studies, funding the local chambers of commerce through front groups that nobody realized were being funded by big oil. They convinced Californians that this tiny tax on the most profitable corporations in the history of the world was going to lead to increased gasoline prices. And this is the same argument that Governor Palin is making, and Obama, and McCain, for why we need to drill offshore. This is the way that they're getting out of our ability to regulate them. So the winners are these oil companies. The oil companies, through mergers, through consolidating refining, through consolidating gas stations, have become literally the most profitable corporations ever the world has ever known. Far, far, far more profitable, by the way, than any other industry in the world. So one of the things I do in the book is add up all of the different industries in the world and all the different industries in the United States and try and compare their profit to big oil. And there's just no comparison, not defense, not pharmaceuticals, not telecommunications, not Google. There's no remote comparison. And that makes this industry the most powerful industry. And when these companies, however, while they are the most profitable companies in the history of the world, are also in the most precarious position they've ever been in. The resource on which their industry depends is running out, and they know it. And they know that they are going to have to work very, very hard to remain oil companies. However, they are deeply committed to remaining oil companies. They were making really high profits when oil was selling at $30 a barrel. With oil selling at $100 a barrel, $150 a barrel, even $80 a barrel, it's still incredibly profitable for them to stay in this business, and they intend to do that. So if they have to drill offshore, if they have to suck a teeny tiny bit of oil out of shale, out of rock, out of tar, if they have to go to war or send us to war in Iraq and in Iran, they will do it, because that's the only way that they can stay oil companies when we live in a world where we consume 4 to 6 barrels of oil for every one that we produce. The oil is running out. There are more people who want it. There's more competition for it. And the oil companies not only want to have access to oil, they want to call the oil theirs. It's called booking the oil. If they can book the oil, own the reserves, that increases their stock value. And that's what they want. They also win when the price of oil rises. And one of the most important changes that's happened in the oil industry, and which is directly linked to the financial collapse we're in the midst of, was deregulation. And again, I go into this in depth in the book, and of course we'll do so at Bookshop Santa Cruz next week. Deregulation of crude markets, crude oil futures markets, made it possible for the run-up in the price of crude to take place over the last 8 years. What we're experiencing right now, and that's the same deregulation, the same bill, in fact, that deregulated much of the financial services industry and allowed for this massive financial collapse we're in the midst of right now. The speculation within the subprime mortgage market, speculation within the financial sector, is the same type of speculation that we're now seeing in crude. The massive volatility in the price of crude we're seeing right now is because of the fact that we're in this deregulated market. But and we are seeing lower gas prices. But I do not think that people should feel a sense of security in that, because the strongest likelihood is that the price is going to be bouncy, but it's going to make its way back up because we've turned over so much control to the oil industry.
And how does that work, how they're setting the price? Can you explain how the price?
Sure.
Is
and
set?
If I can just throw this out there again, because this is complicated, a little complicated, but I will be talking about it and can answer questions Wednesday, October 15th, when I'll be at Bookshop Santa Cruz at 7:30, and then folks can ask me questions directly on this. So the sort of easy, short answer is that in 2000, the oil industry, the banks, and Enron lobbied the Congress, and in particular, Senator Phil Graham, who was the largest recipient of Enron money of any other elected official, and one of the largest recipients of oil industry money. They lobbied Phil Graham, and he succeeded in deregulating crude oil futures markets. Now, just to understand what that means, it's very simple, because the first winner of this deregulation, and this was for all energy sectors, was Enron, because Enron had set up its own deregulated exchange called Enron Online, and the immediate impact was the California energy crisis. Enron created a false scarcity in electricity, sent the price skyrocketing, our economy suffered the consequences, Enron imploded as a result, but Enron's energy traders went to work at the oil companies, at the banks, and in their own hedge funds. And instead of trading in electricity, they're trading in crude oil at an unregulated crude oil exchange, very similar to Enron Online, called the Intercontinental Exchange. And this unregulated exchange is now where crude futures are being traded. And the same traders, just like what they did in California, essentially, is what they're doing with crude oil on the unregulated exchanges, sending the price skyrocketing and manipulating price.
So it didn't have anything to do with the scarcity of oil or rising demand.
So I think probably the simplest way to put this is that the world is quite clearly moving very quickly to a place where demand is going to exceed supply. And this is a critical issue. Peak oil is a critical issue. Consumption is a critical issue, which I talk about a lot. But right now, we are not at that point where demand exceeds supply. Right now, particularly in the United States, we literally have an excess of crude sitting in storage facilities all across the United States. It's called it's called crude stocks, the amount of stocks we have sitting around the United States. From the oil industry's perspective, this is a huge problem because they have too much crude on hand. That brings the price down. That brings the gas prices down, and that's not something they like. So one of the things they've been doing since 2006 is increasing the amount of oil that they export out of the United States and increasing the amount of gasoline that they export out of the United States. That's a way to keep the price high. And they would like, of course, to see the price high. The reason why the price of oil has gone up so quickly is certainly concern out of demand and supply, and certainly markets are tight, and that certainly contributes to the price. But the primary determinant has been these deregulated, speculative trading, just like in the subprime mortgage market, just like in the Enron electricity market here, driving the price ever higher without anyone watching over the trades to see what's going on. So that speculative trading in crude has tripled just in the last few years. Every single one of those trades is like demand for crude, even though no one's actually taking hold of it. It actually creates a false demand, driving up the price. So if we actually want to, I certainly don't advocate that gas prices should be lower or that crude oil should be lower, but I do advocate that we need to invest in our ability to transition away from these products so that it's not so detrimental and so devastating to so many people's lives and to our economy and the global economy. The primary determinant of the price of gasoline is the price of oil, but the rest of the price in the United States is controlled by big oil, which has taken over the gasoline stations, taken over the refineries, and makes pricing decisions on gasoline. So if we want to take greater control over the price of gasoline and, say, capture the benefits by taxing it and then using that money to invest in public transit, for example, instead of letting big oil control whether the price goes up or down, instead of putting that money into their already overstuffed pockets, then we need to look at regulating, reining in, breaking up, taking on this industry.
I'm speaking with Antonia Juhas. She's the author of a new book, The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. She's going to be at the bookshop Santa Cruz Wednesday night at 7:30 p.m. to talk about her book and to answer your questions. Just have a couple more questions for you. Do you have a few more minutes?
Sure.
So basically, are you saying this is all possible, the economic consequences, the consequences on the environment, on human health, and global warming, all these things, and war, you've mentioned that as well. Maybe we can have that be the next thing we address. This is all possible because of the amount of money involved and that these big oil companies basically are kind of controlling our political system. Is that the bottom line?
Yeah, our demand for their product, our addiction to their product, coupled with their economic and political might. I would say the twin forces that are driving us down the negative path. Their economic and political control influences decision-making for the local, state, federal, international level, and then our craving for their product allows them to exercise that control.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have, as you mentioned, a whole chapter devoted to big oil's influence on, well, U.S. foreign policy, in particular in the Middle East right now, but kind of their plans for the future and the fact that these wars are for oil that are going on right now.
Yeah, so. I mean, I think it's probably one of the more critical chapters of the book. And basically looking at, one, the fact that the oil companies themselves are set to run out of oil. They will run out of the oil that they own if nothing changes right around the year 2016. So they really need to get their hands on oil if they want to stay oil companies, and as I argue in the book, they do intend to stay oil companies. And there's really just a few places where oil still exists in sizable quantities in the world. And the primary place is the Middle East. So 50% just about of the world's oil, conventional oil that's left, is in just three countries, Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. And the United States uses military support, massive contributions to weapons and financial support to the Saudi royals to maintain our relationship with Saudi Arabia. And we have essentially used the military off and on over the last 50 years to go back and forth between Iran and Iraq in having access to those countries' oil. Right now, we're in the midst of a war with Iraq for its oil, and we're threatening war with Iran for its oil. And what I look at is all of the military expansion, the vast military expansion of the Bush administration, the largest military buildup all around the world since the start of the Cold War. And it essentially mirrors the locations in the world where oil is found and oil transit routes. And I look at Africa, South America, Central America, the Caspian region, the Middle East, and look at the correlation between where the oil lies and where our military is being sent, and find quite clearly that the United States military in the words of Kevin Phillips has become a oil protective force. And as someone that I am a person who works very closely with veterans, U.S. military veterans and members of the military, who are very, very upset that this is the way that the military is being used, and that that's what they're being asked to fight for, this was an important chapter for me to write, and I think will provide very useful information for activists continuing to fight to stop the war and to bring the troops home now.
So if things continue the way that they are now, basically we'll have more wars, we're going to have more environmental destruction as the companies try to get every last drop of oil from every possible place in every possible way, and, of course, it's going to impact our health, and it's going to be, as you've already talked about, how it impacts our democracy, And as oil gets more scarce, this is probably just going to get worse and worse. So what is the hopeful note, I guess? What is, I know that you spend some time in your book talking about kind of alternatives, and you've already addressed that a little bit, but maybe that would be a good way to kind of round up today. And then if people have more questions, they can come and ask you next Wednesday, October 15th at the Bookshop Santa Cruz at 7:30.
Yeah, absolutely. My hope and my intention is that this is actually a hopeful book. It begins with successful activism and organizing in the United States against the largest, most powerful corporation in the world at the time, Standard Oil. I tell stories throughout the book of successful activism, and I end by pointing to all of the amazing ideas and groups and organizing that is happening, that just needs our support and needs our participation, and that includes all of the various amazing alternative energy forms that are out there, ideas for reducing consumption, for leading by example. So instead of having, for example, India, which is now trying to mimic the United States highway building effort that we engaged in massive highway building in the 50s, and India is now mimicking that highway building plan, instead of leading by that type of example, to lead by example with, say, following a European model with a far more vast expense, far more intensive focus on smaller, greener cities, localizing our energy use, reducing our consumption, and investing in public transit and clean, green public transit. But to achieve those ends, the real focus of my book, of course, is what are the political obstacles to all of these wonderful ideas that we know are out there. And I argue that the biggest political obstacle are the oil companies. And so one is I call for breaking up the oil companies again. We're in a very similar circumstance that we were in before, where the companies are just too big for us to be able to regulate them, too big for us to be able to make with a democratic capacity the critical decision making we're facing now with issues of climate change, of environmental destruction, of war. And if we're going to make decisions as a nation about where to go, how far we are willing to go to get what's left of the oil, how we're going to compete for others for it, I think we have to get big oil off our back to make those decisions in a democratic fashion. And then a policy idea for achieving that end is a really creative campaign that people at the folks at Oil Change International, who I work with, came up with, called the Separation of Oil and state, calling on elected officials to renounce oil industry money and pledging as individuals to vote for the least oily candidate out there to try and get the power and influence of this money out of our campaigns so that we can advocate for stronger policies. And then, of course, at the end of the day, the bottom line always throughout the book is that it's organizing and the work that we do in our communities, in our social groups, in our communities of organizing that has the most powerful, most lasting change, and will have to continue, you know, regardless of whatever happens with any election, whether it's at the local level or the national level, and calling for us to, feel a little more empowered that we have the capacity to bring about the change that we desire, because there's lots of other people out there working for it, organizing for it, and, you know, we've done it before, we can do it again.
I've been speaking with Antonia Juhas. Again, she's a leading oil industry, international trade, and finance policy expert and author of The Bush Agenda and now The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. She's going to be in Santa Cruz Wednesday at Bookshop Santa Cruz on October 15th at 7:30 p.m. So please show up there at the bookshop and talk with her and ask her questions about it. She also, it looks like you have a website, tyrannyofoil.com, that has some, maybe you could just quickly mention what's available there.
Yeah, please do visit that site, tyrannyofoil.com. You can email me there and ask me questions. You can also find a lot more information about the book, the articles I've written, other interviews I've done, and there's also links to lots of different activist organizations, international research organizations, local organizations. There's news articles. It's basically, you know, my place where I put all the information that I think is interesting and useful, and hopefully will be useful to you as well. And as I said, a place where you can send me emails and ask questions directly there as well.
Again, that's tyrannyofoil.com.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. Look forward to seeing you in Santa Cruz, Antonia.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, and have a great night.
You too. Again, Antonia Juhas will be in Santa Cruz coming up Wednesday, October 15th at 7:30 p.m. at Bookshop Santa Cruz. Check it out. Thanks so much for listening.